call the Education Committee for February 23rd to order. We do not yet have a quorum, so we will not be taking official action, but we've got time pressures on us, and I know we've got people here to testify. So Senator Wigger is going to offer to move your bill, Senate File 1908,
yep.
And the author's amendment to it. And that is before us, and you can describe it, discuss it, and I think senators will be dribbling in here, but we will not take a vote on it until we have a quorum. But we can go ahead and take testimony as well. So,
okay.
So welcome, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I am presenting the Senate File 1908, and we do have an author's amendment. Should we do that now, then?
Well, it's before us, so discuss it. We cannot vote on
okay.
it until we have a quorum.
Okay. Senate File 1908 is a bill that I call the CPR education bill. It is a bill that requires schools to provide CPR or AED using a defibrillator and that instruction once in the lifetime of a student. And I'm not going to go into the details. I'm going to let others do that, but I do want to say that it has a little controversy, and the controversy is really around the word mandate. Nobody likes to mandate. I don't like mandating things, and I don't think anybody else really likes to, but there are times that I think mandates are important, and that's when they deal with things that we highly value, and in this case, we highly value life. So your job today, of course, is to decide if this is important enough. If taking 30-minute course out of the lifetime of a student that could possibly save someone's life, and we do have some testimony of that, is worth a mandate. As a former instructor in first aid, I say it is. I think everybody, and I almost expect that everybody has first aid or at least CPR instruction on knowing if a situation comes up, do we know how to deal with it? Even in the last week, there was a one-year-old that was at a sports event, and the mother went to the restroom, and the child was given to one of the, I think it was a dance competition, and the baby stopped breathing and started turning blue, and she yelled for help, and somebody was there, I believe it was a coach, came over and gave CPR until, they had also called 911 until somebody could come, and that was within the last week. It happens all the time. I've in a sense, saved two people in my lifetime just because I was there at the right time, the right place, with on the beach with everybody else standing around and saying, does anybody know CPR? And, you jump in, you start doing it. And pretty soon the paramedics show, and they take over, and that life was saved. So, again, we're talking about a life issue, and I think it's important. I also, before we go on any further, want to thank those that co-authored this, Senator Stump, Wigger, and DeKreif. So with that, I have some others here that would like to give some testimony, and if we can start out with Justin Bell with the American Heart Association, I think that would probably be best.
Thank you very much. Introduce yourself for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Justin Bell. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association here in Minnesota. I want to thank everyone for taking time to hear this bill today, and thanks, Senator Hall, for authoring it. I just wanted to point out a couple of the quick sort of an overview of it, and we'll move really quickly through the testifiers that we have.
Sure.
The bill asks to train students in CPR one time, as little as 30 minutes, sometime between 7th and 12th grade. So we're talking about 30 minutes over a six-year period. And during that six-year period, students are required to receive 367,200 minutes of education. And so we're asking to take 30 minutes of that, or 0.08% to learn how to potentially save a life. We've taken great pains to make sure that we can do this as flexibly as possible for schools. We wanted to leave it open for schools to make the choice to put it where it makes sense for them. Wanted to make great efforts to make sure that schools that are already doing it don't have to change what they're doing. We believe that about 50% of schools do it already now. We didn't want to mess any of that up. I also want to clarify that there's often confusion about with CPR over what's certification versus training. And we're not talking about certification. We're talking about hands-only CPR training, which is adopting the newest guidelines of just using your hands for chest compressions, and it can be taught in about 30 minutes. I myself am a CPR instructor. I've taught the course many times in as little as about 23 minutes. So it's a very simple, very accessible program. Another point that we always want to bring out is that the teaching methods have gotten so much easier. One of the methods that come from the American Heart Association is called CPR Anytime. It can be taught off of a DVD, so there's no additional training required for any teachers or administrative staff at schools. We are pleased to have the Minnesota Resuscitation Consortium here today, and Kim Harkins will speak to the fact that they have resources available for schools. We believe that many of these resources have always been available. Most schools that do this utilize their community, their local EMS, their local fire department, police, their local police department, or other volunteer groups. The MRC is doing a good job of coordinating those resources, as well as finding a catch-all. So if a school somehow can't lock in with those, they can send them and grant them the materials so that there's no cost to schools to do that. The last thing I just want to mention is that just to show how easy this is, on March 7th, we're going to have a day on the Hill here with the American Red Cross, the American Heart Association, and at noon, we're going to train everybody that wants to in CPR in the Rotunda of the Capitol. We're going to invite legislators, staff, it's open to the public, and we'll show you in that 25 to 30 minutes exactly what we're talking about and exactly how simple it is to learn a skill that can potentially save someone's life. And in the packet of materials that you had, I would just draw your attention to a brochure from the Resuscitation Consortium that talks about the types of materials that are available to schools for free. I'd also draw your attention to a letter of support from the Medtronic Corporation. The Medtronic Corporation has invested lots of money into trying to save lives from sudden cardiac arrest and getting CPR training out there, and they believe that this bill furthers their mission. And so I'll stay up for questions, but I believe that Kim Harkins would be the...
Well, so I think this is the time for the announcement that cell phones and iPads that are cellular should be turned off. They do conflict with the system in this room, this particular room. So we'll say that we do have a quorum present, and so we do have the Senator Wieger's motion before us. To move the author's amendment to Senate File 1908. So if you all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And thank you. May I just ask you a question. When you say that you can teach it in 23 minutes, is that only just demonstrating it? At what point, you know, I'm one who believes in the hands-on learning, and that if you do it, you're more likely to retain it and feel more comfortable using it than if you just watch somebody do it. Is that a part of it? And I would think that if you had a whole class doing that, and maybe that's not the way you suggest teaching it, that there would need to be some kind of time for people to either practice or determine whether they've got the right technique.
That is an excellent question, Madam Chair, and you are exactly right. What the science shows is that the psychomotor component or the hands-on component of doing chest compressions are really what it takes to have people remember how to do it, how hard you have to push, how fast you have to push. And already in law is a statute that says if a school teaches CPR, they have to follow national guidelines and include a psychomotor component. So you're exactly right. That's a okay. Key component in getting people to remember.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there questions of Mr. Bell? If not, why don't you move to your other witnesses?
Go ahead. Introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Kim Harkins. I'm the program manager of the Minnesota Resuscitation Consortium, which is an initiative at the University of Minnesota. I'm also a volunteer firefighter in my community, and I am a past high school teacher, so I'm very familiar with what it takes to implement a program in the classroom. The Resuscitation Consortium is part of the Heart Rescue Project through the Medtronic Foundation, and our focus really is to improve survival from sudden cardiac arrest by 50% in the next 5 years. We know that sudden cardiac arrest is a big problem in the United States, affecting almost 350,000, with survival rates nationwide of right around 7%. So it's very, very low. We know that sudden cardiac arrest does not discriminate by age. We have sudden cardiac arrest victims as young as 12, and obviously even one where they're performing CPR. So we know that this affects anybody, any place, anytime. The consortium is very proud to be working on this CPR for in schools bill because we truly believe that what we are doing is connecting resources in community, fire, EMS, and hospitals to be able to provide more CPR training. One of our goals is to train 10% of the population of Minnesota because we know that we can change the outcomes from sudden cardiac arrest by having more people do bystander CPR. Bystander CPR can double, if not triple, a person's chance of survival. High school students are a wonderful captive audience. They're ready to learn. That's what they're in the classroom to do. So we feel this is a great group to be looking at. The consortium also, because of our partnerships with Fire and EMS, have helped to develop the brochure as well as a website where schools could, if they did not already have CPR in their curriculum, could go to this website, look for local resources, and be able to connect with speakers, with equipment. We know that most EMS, fire, and professional agencies already have equipment that's probably sitting in closets, only getting used once a year. So they're more than happy to work with schools, and it gives them an opportunity to go in and share their expertise with students. So we are already working to develop those resource lists and those connections between schools and their community resources. The other thing that Justin mentioned is we're in the process of putting together kits that could be provided to schools who absolutely are unable to find resources in their communities. Those kits include mannequins, videos, all of the tools they would need to easily implement the 20-25 minute class that Justin talked about. The mannequins have the ability to provide that psychomotor skill so that students would be able to actually practice in the classroom setting. So I really think that we're in a great position right now to see this go throughout Minnesota schools so that we can say that all Minnesota students have been trained in CPR and are ready to be our next generation of heroes.
Thank you. Any questions of the witness? Thank you very much, Ms. Harkins. Be sure you sign up. I've got a pad for you all to be sure that the witnesses sign up.
Hi, my name is Jamie Lalonde.
Welcome,
and
Jamie.
I'm here today because I'm part of the lucky 8% that survived a sudden cardiac arrest. I was 18 when I had mine while working at the Mall of America in Forever 21. I collapsed, and nobody knew what to do, so they called mall security. They were there within 5 minutes, and somebody started performing CPR. 2 minutes later, Bloomington police showed up and shocked me with an AED twice. I was transferred to Fairview Southdale, where I was put in a coma to prevent brain damage. They woke me up 2 days later, and I was transferred to U of M for tests. They still can't tell me why it happened. And then after that, I started thinking that I was around a bunch of 16 to 20-year-olds who had no idea what to do once I hit the floor, and then I realized I wouldn't have known what to do either. The hospital told me I was very lucky. Somebody was around to know that new CPR to save me. And that's why I'm helping the American Heart Association make sure that all high school students get some kind of CPR training. Because if someone you loved suffered a cardiac arrest, wouldn't you want to increase the chances of somebody around them knowing what to do to save them? And by simply taking 30 minutes one time to teach kids CPR, they could end up saving someone's life. And that's why I'm alive, is because somebody who knew CPR acted. And so thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lalonde. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Dale Wakasugi.
Okay, welcome.
I'm from Woodbury, a longtime resident there, and I'm a survivor of sudden cardiac arrest from 4 years ago. I was refereeing a boys' basketball game at Fridley High School, and with a few minutes left in the game, without warning, I went down with sudden cardiac arrest. And within seconds, several bystanders, including a 16-year-old high school student, came to my aid. Did good CPR, and with the use of an AED and one shock, brought me back to life. As was mentioned earlier, sudden cardiac arrest is the number one killer in the United States, and yet we don't hear too much about it because the survival rate is so low. People don't survive it. With good CPR and an AED, we can help increase those percentages up to 85%, and that's why it's important. So I urge you to consider this bill. because without good CPR and people, bystanders responding and the use of an AED, I can just about guarantee you I would not be here alive today able to talk about this. It's not expensive, doesn't take a lot of time or equipment, and it's not that time consuming. This high school student or this age group that we're talking about could be your child, it could be your grandchild, it could be a friend. And the chances, if somebody goes down with sudden cardiac arrest, the chances of them doing this at home is very high. And the life that they could possibly save could be yours. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you very much. Mr. Wakasugi. Okay, thank you.
Hello, my name is Natasha Fleischman. And
I'm
here today as a school board member from Stillwater. I find it very odd that I'm coming in to say, please pass this mandate, because generally when you hear from me, I'm saying, don't do it, don't do it. But on this one, it's different. I've been on the advocacy committee for several years with the American Heart Association, and we've not always agreed, particularly when it came to FIED. But when Justin brought this legislation to me and said, what do you think of it, Natasha? I said, well, schools aren't going to want to do anything if it's going to cost them money. We have no money. In my district, we're cutting $6.5 million from the budget. Tonight, we're presenting the plan. And so I said, it can't cost the schools any money. We don't have money or time to rearrange the curriculum. And that's why I was so thrilled when this piece of legislation was introduced, because it's doing CPR instruction in a very effective way, but without costing the schools money. I have been part of the volunteer teams that go out and teach CPR in the schools. I've done it in Eagan and in Farmington. And like Justin said, we can teach CPR in 30 minutes or less, and it's CPR that can save lives. And that's where it comes to the second reason I'm here, is because my life was saved by CPR. 10 years ago, when I was 33, I had a sudden cardiac arrest, actually at the St. Paul Public School District office. And because a bystander knew CPR and was willing to perform it on me, and the St. Paul Fire Department defibrillated me 5 times, I lived to be able to run for school board and be not elected once, but twice. And so, yes, it's unusual to have school board members ask for a mandate to be placed on them, but I really think the 30 minutes is not much to ask for. We know that at least 50% of the schools in Minnesota are already doing this, and we just want to make sure that the kids who live in districts that don't already do this have the opportunity to learn CPR, so that rather than watching someone die, they can help someone live. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you. Ms. Fleischman.
Anthony Carr, County Executive for the American Red Cross. Madam Chair, committee members.
Would you say your name again?
Anthony Carr.
Anthony Carr.
Yep. And I'm a
thank
county
you.
Executive
Welcome, Mr. Carr.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. The American Red Cross strongly supports this bill, with the Red Cross being an organization that believes in saving lives through our blood, as well as through our blood donations, as far as our health and safety training programs, as well as our disaster relief. We truly believe this bill, and we strongly believe in it. And with that, I just would like to say that we feel that with our youth that are learning in schools, it would be great to see them learning and reading, writing, as well as resuscitation. Thank you.
More resuscitation. I like that. That
works. You hit the right chord on the first word. Thank you.
Madam Chair, that's the end of the pro bill testimony.
And I believe Mr. Snyderman is asked to testify as well.
Okay.
Mr. Steinerwin.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneider. I'm on staff of the Minnesota School Boards Association, representing all 340 of our public school districts in the state of Minnesota. And we have had conversations with Senator Hall about this, and he was very respectful about some of our concerns with the bill. And I think I'm just going to raise some issues as you move forward here. And I think the big issue is that our membership has been very strong in encouraging and opposing additional requirements for school districts this year. And it's as we traveled around the state, that's one of the issues that we've heard loud and strong from them. So some of the issues to the bill is the clarity of how much, if any, additional time will be required, if any, for the staff to train. So if you have, for example, staff members who aren't trained in CPR and now we're expecting them to provide that, let's say you're in a community where you may not have access to the firefighters or police officers in a nearby or a nearby community may not have it, that might be some additional requirements for school districts to train those. And remember, if you look online, and I don't know if this lines up with the amendment, but the bill on line 1.8 requires hands-on practice and skills testing to support cognitive learning. And so while we talk about 30 minutes, if you've ever been in an eighth grade health classroom where you've got to provide hands-on and skills testing, that's, by my calculation, certainly going to take a longer time than 30 minutes. And so I think you need to consider that as you move forward on this bill. Is 30 minutes the right time? And my guess is, based on what's required in this bill, it certainly require more time. And then so that talks about, well, we talk about the amount of time of instruction that's been shared publicly. There's nothing in the bill that itemizes the amount of time that's required in the bill. So I think that needs to be reviewed as well. And I think one of the duties of districts as it relates to the requirement for students, do districts need to keep track of the students who have not and who have been through this? I know the amendment took care of part of that. But that's an issue, again, that are we going to be required as administrators or health teachers or FIAT teachers that we need to keep track of those students who have and have not? And one of the other issues that on the local health standards, I mean, those are one of the only locally adopted standards we have anymore. I mean, everything else is ART standards give you an option for a local standard, but the health standards are one of those that are near and dear to school boards, and they enjoy in having control over the curriculum and what's in those standards. So I think that's one of the issues, again, that perhaps if we're creeping in here on requiring CPR, what's going to be the issue next? Is it going to be the use of an EpiPen or some other piece that's health-related? That's some of the things that we're concerned about that this is going to open the door for. And lastly, when I read the bill, first of all, I mean, this was an issue that I thought, well, this happens now. And I just had a conversation with my daughter who's going in eighth grade, who's going through this now in her eighth grade health class. And I think the 50% number that we have, while I don't have an accurate number, my guess and my anecdotes and conversations with other school districts, I would guess that number is low. Between 7th and 12th grade, I would either an 8th grade health or 10th grade health, or whether it's through the lifeguard training program that's sometimes within the school, there are options. And so one of the strong things that schools do is reach out to their communities. And I think that they have done that. While some health instructors may provide the CPR training, I think most districts will have their health and FIED folks reach out to the firemen, to the EMTs, to the police officers to have them come in and do this. And I think that's a strong model to get community engagement that ultimately pays off by more buy-in by having your community involved in that. And so I think perhaps some of that may be lost if it's required. I think that large part, some of this is already covered in the community use of resources. And so those are just some of the issues that we have to think about as you move forward on this bill.
Thank you. Senator Hall?
Madam Chair,
thank
could
you,
I?
Mr. Schreiner.
Yes, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Could I have Mr. Bell respond to some of that?
Pardon me? Yes.
Could I?
By all means.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Just a few points. I think the first thing I'd like to say is I actually think that he's exactly right that the number 50% is low. We also believe that that number is low. There's no data available for what schools are doing right now. The only data that we've been able to point to is we did an internal poll where we broke the state up into sections and just cold called schools. I would guess that that number is low, and more than 50% do that. The notion that this would, we don't know how much extra training for staff that this would require. One of the options for training is, for example, the American Heart Association CPR Anytime Kit, which can be taught off of a DVD. There's lots of different ways to do it, but if you pop in the DVD and walk through the steps, it goes through step by step. There's no extra training required to do that, and no one has to be licensed or certified to teach that method. The timing, as far as skills testing is already built into the 25 to 30 minutes. It's part of having the instructor making sure that you actually hear the click on the mannequin when you push down hard enough and just watch how fast it is. And so there's lots of simple methods to sort of do that as we're going through. So skills testing is built into that time frame. And the tracking issue is something that we've dealt with the language quite a bit on this, trying to figure out how we can make that non-burdensome for schools or the minimal amount of or less burdensome. Our intention is not at all to have schools track any individual student. The intention was to have it placed somewhere where the majority of students are going to come across it. The amendment specifically tries to exempt students that have transferred in after. So if one school decides that they're going to do it in 9th grade, Phi-Ed, and the student transfers in 10th grade, that student doesn't have to be tracked down to take it. Or if a student's absent the day that it's taught in health class, the school doesn't have to track down that individual student.
Thank you very much. Is there, are there further questions of him? I'm trying to engross your amendment for all students in that grade. Okay. So are you proposing that this be taught in just one, that the school would pick one grade and then would do that rather than have flexibility as to where it was to occur?
Madam Chair, the idea was to give a period of time where schools and districts could choose what grade it made more sense. We were very sensitive to not want to mess up something that a school is already doing. We found some schools that do it regularly in junior high or middle school. We didn't want to mess that up. If a school did it a specific way, we wanted to allow the flexibility to do it wherever it made sense for that district and to allow some local control over that. But the intent is just one time at some point during that period.
Senator Wolk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to make a couple comments. First of all, as one of my licensures is health education, and I spent 8 years teaching 8th grade health, so it was interesting to hear that analogy there. I've always been a firm believer that everyone should not only have CPR, but also should have basic first aid. So I'm glad to see steps being made this way. And I would agree that I think most school districts already hit this, but there are many who do not. And when this bill was brought to me, I had two concerns as a teacher for the schools. Number one was cost, and number two was the potential paperwork nightmare. And I think the authors did a very good job of addressing those, and so I am a supporter of the bill.
Senator Bana, or did you have your hand up? Senator Wieger, I think, was first.
Fine. Madam Chair, I did have my hand up. I did ask Mr. Nauman the question. He's looking. I wondered if it's the author's intent that this apply to charter schools, and we're checking now to see if that, in fact, would be.
Well, my understanding is I talked with Mr. Piccolo earlier today and didn't believe that it did, but wouldn't mind if it did, because he, too, is one whose life was saved by CPR, I think, within
really?
The last couple of years.
Right, Madam Chair.
So, I mean, that personal experience does have an impact.
It does not in the form it's in, and that was not our intent, but it can be broadened. We're not looking at doing that right now.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you wouldn't mind just indulging me for a moment with a personal story. So my cousin, who is somewhat famous because his name is Bobby Z and he was the drummer for Prince, he almost died last year, and it was actually pretty public, but he had a heart attack. He was dead on the table in the hospital. The rabbi was there. His children were all there. His siblings flew in, say goodbye. I mean, it was very horrible experience, and somehow he did survive that, and there was no logic behind it, but he survived. He came out of it, and because of that, he is now devoting much of his energy towards heart healthy education. And so I was privileged last Sunday night to go to a reunion concert of The Revolution, where he got the members of the band to fly back from all over the world, and we thought Prince was coming. Prince disappointed us, but but the people at the play, and it was the Purple Heart concert, and those who served us in this First Avenue nightclub said it was the most crowded they had ever seen this place. And you know, and people talked about heart health, and people were on the screen telling their stories, and it was such a beautiful community event about the importance of heart health and this very serious issue. So you touched a chord with me, and I hope this bill becomes law.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for sharing that, Senator Bonoff. Are there any others in the audience that would like to testify? We do have some time limits here, so we don't want to extend this too long.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers and head the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. I got involved with the American Heart Association after my mother died of a heart attack, and I also had another family member die. And they could have been saved had there been CPR training by those of those who were around them at the time, but they waited for the paramedics to come, and so time was lost. And of course, so I took a number of years off as far as coming to the legislature and doing work just to deal with the personal issues that gets involved. I also know that there's huge cost savings when you have more people trained in the community to do CPR, because you never know where or when it happens. And I think out on the West Coast too, as some of the senators were saying, everybody should be trained. One of the states, I don't know whether was it Washington State or something, said they wanted to get all their citizens trained on CPR, and that reduced their health care costs by, there was a significant healthcare cost savings. And I know this legislature is concerned about lowering healthcare costs, and this is one of the methods of prevention. And it also saves lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. This bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Senator DeCraig?
Madam Chair, I just, and this kind of goes back to one of Senator Wieger's questions about the charter schools. Is there, if charter schools are in fact not included in this, what are the ramifications and what would have to be done if we wanted to include them in this?
Well, I think without having somebody here on that, if we lay this over for possible inclusion, it doesn't mean we're finished. There may be some things that could be changed that could accommodate not only the charter schools, but also the School Board Association, if there's some further tweaking of it without compromising the objective. So
we do have an amendment prepared addressing charter schools, but as it's laid over, other ideas can be considered as it's
sure. Would you care to move prepared to?
If you'll entertain that, yes, I'll ask
Ms.
Butler.
I meant to lay it over for possible inclusion.
So moved.
Okay. Thank you very much. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The bill is laid over. Thank you very much for your testimony. It's powerful, and I believe we will find the way to accomplish it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Nelson isn't here. Senator Bonoff, would you mind taking the gavel for the testimony on the bill I'm carrying?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. We are going to continue some of the testimony that was we weren't able to take yesterday. We're under some of the same kind of time pressure, so I'm not sure we're going to be taking action. But so if there are ones here that are ready to testify that we're
okay. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, would you like to take the bill from the table or just do the testimony?
Let's do the testimony, I
great.
Think,
okay.
Because we aren't going to be amending it at this point, but let's take that testimony and then we'll...
Very good. Thank you.
So,
who's going to... Scott, can you go first? Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Scott Sands. I'm a parent. Four kids have gone through the St. Paul School District. Senator Olson, I believe, invited me to speak to you because just to add some anecdotes that support the research that that you have before you. The issue seems to be, will we provide, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Mr. Sands.
Sorry. To provide PSEO experience for kids at a younger age and also to reduce the limitations of your ranking, class ranking, correct? So this is a very specific issue. It affects a very small section, a short section of these children's lives. It's 9th through 10th grade, basically, right? Kids come to, there's an assembly when you enter 9th grade where the children are told, your past doesn't matter. It's wiped clean. Now you are starting fresh, and you can see the kids, they sit up straight. I'm here, I'm now going to contribute to my community, I can do this. But very quickly, by the time they get to their first conference, many of them feel a little less confident. Many of them are already destroyed, clearly. So what happens? Have they given up? Have they decided they can't do it? Or have they had experiences they simply can't relate to? Okay, I would say it's that. You know, I've had four boys, gone through it. There's a couple educators they don't relate to. They give them D's, N's. If they're lucky, a C. By the time you're done with that, your grade point average is pretty low. Okay. Are they bad teachers? No, they're very good teachers because other kids are doing exceptionally well and are now off in college, off doing tremendous research, and they'll say that these specific teachers are the reason they're there. So my kids want to succeed also, right? And so do many other kids. So why wouldn't we create a system where we can bring other folks in that these kids could relate to the kids who are not succeeding up to that? Okay, the other issue is then, okay, my kid has poor grade point average. Is he not going to succeed in college? Well, Alec is now at the University of Minnesota in the second year of graduate school in the architecture program. Okay. His advisor told him, you already have the skills to contribute significantly to the field of architecture. Zachary has a job at Target. He couldn't get into the University of Minnesota right away. He had to go to a different school because of his grade point average, but he ended up at the U, set the curve at many of his classes. Now works at Target as a data analyst, and they are already telling him he's fast-tracking, right? Okay, so he can succeed also. Walter, who basically gave up in high school, just totally trashed him, okay? He's probably the brightest child I have. So we had to take him out. We put him in online education. The teachers had more time. They could work with him, and they... Am I going too long?
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay. Good testimony, but if you could wrap it up, okay. We have to actually end this part of the hearing at 4.
Okay,
so
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
But he went off to Moorhead. The teachers appreciate him. He's doing great. It's wonderful.
So you're a proponent of this bill, and you see that it can make a difference.
Oh, very definitely.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Sands.
Thank you.
You'll sign up here. This, just for the record, because it may not have gone on, this is Senate file 1531 on post-secondary enrollment options and addressing largely the point of opening that for a one-course option in career tech in a career tech field that will be open to 9th and 10th graders.
Very good.
I'll try to make this quick. My name is Bandal Lee. I'm just going to start with my story, and I'll wrap it up with a quick current story so you're up to date with communities who don't speak English. I am a low-income first-generation to high school and college student. I was born in a refugee camp, and I came to the United States in 1989. In Thailand, my mother completed fifth grade, which was the highest that was offered there. My father barely made second grade. With barely an education background from my parents, they were trying to survive America, working two jobs and trying to learn English. They just really didn't have any goals for us. And from our little clan, the highest was high school, and so that was their highest expectations of us. I'm a woman, so they thought I was going to just get married, and they wanted me to just find a job. So I participated in dual credit as of ninth grade. And Scott said, 7th and 8th, I just want to point out that that's really crucial, because if you're already in honors class in that level, they'll put you right into an AP class or honors class your ninth grade year, and that's exactly what happened to me. I've been participating in dual credit since my ninth grade year, from AP all the way to CIS. I want to do PSEO, and I wished I could have. That would have helped my transition exposure to campus life a little more, but I didn't. But the academic rigor, the exposure to the campus when we visited for college and the schools, and the language that I acquired about college, my parents didn't know what college was. So being able to say, I am going to go to college, what is college, what do I need to do to get there, was really important. It boosted my academic momentum to succeed, and I definitely carried that over when I went to St. Olaf College and completed that. I just want to say that I personally truly believe that there is great value. I've seen it with everyone. I've seen McAllister students. Not one of them have not participated in some form of dual credit to be at McAllister, just a FYI. And I personally, honestly, I am a hard worker, but all I needed was just an opportunity. And dual credit helped molded that key for me, because I don't think I would have gotten into St. Olaf College if I didn't have all those AP courses to back up my my high school transcript. And right now, I just want to quickly say a story. I work at the Center for School Change. I do outreach personally in the minority, low-income first generation, and I work closely with MDE. I just want to say that we were on the radio stations to promote dual credit, and the feedback I got, the phone calls that took up my time, which I enjoyed greatly, was the theme was, the frustration was, parents who knew English, parents who've been in America, who've taken some form of dual credit, and parents who barely knew any English, who just came to America, all said, shouldn't schools be telling us this? The dual credit opportunities from PSEO, IB, AP, and college in the schools. And I'm not here to say whose job is what, but I do hope you consider that if college and universities can help us promote that these programs help save time and money, that'd be wonderful. Any way we can do to bring awareness is important. I mean, we've heard people all the way in Duluth who don't even know about these programs, and we need to reach out to them. And so that's my push, and I really, because I've taken it in ninth grade, and I know students who are ready to take them are the ones who will look for them, and so I really encourage that you expand it to ninth and tenth graders if available. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lee. Very inspiring story. Thank you for sharing it. Senator Olson, I know that you had as supporters Jim Bartholomew and Amy Wallstein. Would you prefer to just note that they are supporters and have some of the other in the interest of time?
Or from Growth and Justice, okay, is on the list. I think we should hear from him.
Very good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to support this bill and to speak to you about it today. And actually, Amy and Jim asked me to deliver to you my proxy, their support for this legislation.
Very good, thank you.
That's and, kind of record-setting, isn't it?
That's right. Actually, we work with the Chamber and the Partnership on many issues, and we're happy to work with them on this one. My name is Dane Smith. I'm president of Growth and Justice. We're a policy research and advocacy organization focused on expanding economic prosperity and reducing inequality, economic inequality in Minnesota. We're particularly focused on education policy and reducing the unacceptable gaps that have opened up by income and race in educational achievement and attainment. And these gaps, we know, represent the most serious threat to our long-term economic health in Minnesota. But viewed another more positive way, closing these gaps are also our greatest opportunity for business growth. And there is enormous, diverse, untapped human potential to be realized. So we support this bill and any effective policy that gets this all-important human potential as early as possible, on the track to at least some form of post-secondary attainment and skills training beyond high school. It's for this reason that we also support prenatal investment and early childhood education investment. Our organization has brought considerable research and resources, including some of the nation's top scholars, rigorous evidence testing, cost-effectiveness criteria, to the study of what really works to get to this achievement and attainment and to address the total birth through career track or pipeline. And this research has led us to emphatically embrace the concept of comprehensive and continuous improvement and a more seamless system in Minnesota, one that's designed to prepare preschoolers so they're fully ready, but then boost them right on through to this higher education with as few barriers as possible. In our comprehensive report on this a couple years ago, Smart Investments in Minnesota Students, we strongly endorse the concept of interventions such as early college high schools and that focus on first-generation college hopefuls, low-income English language learner and minority students. On this segment of the pipeline or the track that we labeled Ready for Higher Learning, we said this, quote, and this is scholars speaking, the best scholars in America. All students benefit from participation in accelerated learning programs such as post-secondary enrollment options, including AP courses and college in the school's course. PSEO emerged not just as a desirable option, but as one of the most cost-effective interventions to move our kids where they need to go. We recommended actually spending money on this. More money, considerably more, up to $95 million more for early college track programs. And the benefit-to-cost ratio is estimated to be $2.50 for every $1 that we invested. So this is an investment. I don't want to torture this analogy of a railroad track too much, but a nonstop all-the-way-through track is the principle to pursue. We were pleased to be influential in getting early childhood educators to work more closely with K-3 educators, so that that barrier is being broken down. We really need to knock down every way we can the barriers that exist between K-12 and post-secondary. Kids and their parents, especially those who are having a lot of trouble navigating an unfair economy already, are unfairly challenged in navigating between the train terminal at the end of the line in high school and then finding their way across town to a completely separate, different train system that delivers them to the destination they really need to go. This early PSEO stuff can really deliver the goods there. Just one final note. I'm aware of some of the MNSCU administrative opposition to the 9th and 10th grade options. I spoke earlier yesterday with a representative of the faculty organization. I'm not qualified to debate in depth all of the tricky details on how to provide that increased access, particularly in the 9th and 10th grades. other members in our the group that are pushing for this can address that. But I urge you to push as hard as possible for maximum access for those kids who currently don't have this option. And we are working with Minsku, Inver Hills, Century College in particular on their efforts to integrate high school curriculum and post-secondary preparation so that our kids need less remedial instruction. There are lots of other ways we can work towards this seamlessness. And I do want to commend Chancellor Rosenstone and the Minsku and faculty for elevating this obstacle reduction and gap closing as a top priority. I know they're doing a lot of things on their own in the same vein. But increasing this emphasis brought to it by all our higher education leaders, public, private, for-profit, we recognize that and toast that too, celebrate that. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, is it okay to ask you?
Senator Weaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Smith, part of your very interesting, diverse career, I believe, was being an instructor in the community college system.
That's right.
Can you wear that hat in from the perspective as an instructor with potentially ninth grade students?
Boy, Senator Weaker, I am glad you asked that question, Madam Chair.
Mr. Smith.
I did teach for about 4 years a course in state policy and politics at Inver Hills Community College. And I had a couple of PSEO students in my class, one of them as young as 16, I think. They were among my very best students. They were there because they wanted to be. They were motivated. I remember I had one student who sat in the back and was working on an iPad before most of us knew what they were, and was challenging some of my assertions. And this student actually ended up as a employee in the House Republican Caucus before he got out of high school. So these PSE students are remarkable. We know there are a lot more out there, and not just top students who would thrive with this option. Many times, students are just on a different wavelength than their high school teachers, just not cut out for the high school experience, the regimentation, the whole structure, and they just take off if they're given a shot at a college level course.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Thank you. We need to let the con folks say. I don't know if there's somebody.
Well, Madam Chair,
is there room for one? Otherwise, if we haven't got that, I think these are folks that could come back because we haven't taken it off the table, and we're not going to abandon hearing some more if we ever get out of this tight time structure we've got for our education.
I know.
Committee.
Well, Madam Chair, it is 4 o'clock, so it's up to you if you want to get one in just to get a sense of what the con argument is, or we could just end right now and move to our next subject.
Well, if there is one that could express that in a couple of minutes, I think we could probably handle and complete.
Okay, very good. So it would either Gary Amoroso, Roger Aronson, Paul whoever thinks they could do it in one. We're just going to take one. Just for now. We'll get you another time, though.
Hey,
and I'm sorry. Okay.
Madam Chair, members, my name's Roger Aronson. I represent the Secretary of Principals Association. We brought Paul Neubauer, who's one of our principals, along to give you some background about PSEO, some of the concerns about the bill. This is his second trip here from St. Francis, so in the lobbying community in the back said we thought we might put him on.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Aronson. Mr. Neubauer.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Paul Neubauer, principal at St. Francis High School. I've been a public school administrator for 12 years, 9 of which as a high school principal. Today I would like to talk to you about my role as a principal and about programming. I see the principal's role to apply local, state, and federal policies and procedures and to use my judgment as I apply them to afford consistency in the application of those policies and procedures to the betterment of student learning. As principals, we absolutely respect the opinions of parents and students, but must also navigate through policies and procedures that we are held to. And I believe the parents expect us to use their tax dollars to fund pre-K-12 public education. We have two comments we often speak to when looking to solve issues. The first is, what is the problem we are trying to solve? The second is fix a problem, create a problem. Hopefully, the impact of the problem we fix is more significant than the one we created with the solution. We're a high school of 1,600 students. We have 46 PSEO students this year, resulting in a loss of $310,000 in state aid. In order to provide our students with college credit in our school, we spend approximately $250,000 for our college in the school's program. This totals $560,000 in expenditures, while we collect $13,500 from the state for our college in the school's program. We lose $168,000 to students who attend ALC, and we spend $220,000 in programming to fund students who are considered at risk. We lost $235,000 to students who chose to go online, and we spend $60,000 per year to offer hybrid courses to keep students in our school. With these examples, we have invested We have invested in providing industry standard programming for our CT program so our students will have high quality programming that is industry standard. The point is, each time there's an initiative or legislation, schools need to respond to the actual changes that occur and provide a level of programming that holds to the rigor intended and the rigor that's expected from the state and local governing entities. All of these cost money and cause me to have to respond to the parent who is also demanding a high-quality choir program. Given these examples, I believe we have fixed the problem of flexible programming and school choice. The problem we've created is competition over funding afforded to provide the programming. I do have the responsibility to budget in my building. I do believe that I have a higher calling than simply budget. Given what I've heard the last 2 days, I would look to apply our two tests. First, what is the problem we're trying to solve? And secondly, hopefully the impact of the solution is more significant than the resulting problem that we will create. First, the criteria. The top one-third of juniors and the top one-half of seniors, GPA-wise, are admitted into the PSEO program. That's not a high school deal. That's not my deal at all. That's a college and university standard. My job is simply to apply that standard to our students. If what we're trying to fix is that our 9th and 10th grade students need more rigor and more opportunity, that's fine. Let us know that. We have honors programs 9 through 12. We have college in the schools. We could create courses of high rigor in every single department that we have. The high school can provide that. If the question is who pays for college, I would say this. I'm in that unfortunate area of middle income. I have three sons, one who is now out of college, one who's finishing college, and one who is just starting. I have one who has $50,000 in student loan debt. I have another with 30, and I'm anticipating my trailer to have about 40. If I were of the wealthy, I'd write a check and it'd be paid for. If I grew up in poverty, which by the way I did, I would take advantage of grants, subsidized student loans, scholarships. I would take advantage of every opportunity I could, and I would have many of those opportunities. Because I happen to be middle class, I end up with student loan debt for my children, and actually they'll end up with that debt. The thing that I'm most interested in is describing the timeline that we would talk about with implementing a 9th grade and 10th grade college in the schools PSEO program. We would need to identify students midway through their 8th grade year and identify them as qualifying by some set of criteria to enter into the PSEO program. I can tell you I ran the list yesterday in preparation for my testimony today. We're on a trimester system, so we have one grading period that's complete. We have 32 ninth grade students that have a perfect 4.0. We have 38 students that had an A minus in there someplace. They have a 3.96. That totals 70 students. How do we set the criteria? How do we determine who gets into PSEO and who's not? or possibly do we do away with that? The advantage that we have with 11th and 12th grade is by the time this 9th grade class graduates, we'll have five students approximately who are perfect 4.0 students. We'll have another 10 students that had an A-minus someplace in their high school career. So we're talking about maybe 15 kids. It's pretty easy for us to say these kids have passed muster. These kids have earned the privilege to go to post-secondary education. Finally, we believe that the high school can provide supports for students early, ninth grade, and all the way through their senior year. This morning at 6:30, we had Student of the Month, where we have departments who nominate a student every month. We bring in 14 students with their parents. Teachers bring the student down. We say nice things about the student. We watch as the parents are proudly sitting there listening to the fact that we know their child. They're nodding. Some of them are crying. We clap for them. Off they go. In fact, today, one of our last instructors who brought a student up to talk about them, the student was a freshman. He had five other freshmen during the course of the day, and they were all students of the month.
We have to. Yep. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Thank you.
And
Mr. Neubauer?
Yes.
Madam Chair, yeah. Mr. Neubauer, I wish you would provide your testimony, particularly the dollars that you were talking about, the costs, and give a little bit more explanation for our committee, because we will be continuing to discuss and deliberate this and get at, you know, a little bit more amplification and understanding who we're trying to serve. You know, you're talking about the very successful, and that's not the ones we're worried about. So we need to have further discussion on it, but
okay.
I appreciate it very
Thank
much.
You.
Senator Olson, one of the things that occurred to me as I was listening to Mr. Neubauer, keeping in mind the conversations we've been having in finance, is this might be a case to ask for a local impact fiscal note and find out, because those were some pretty strong assertions we were hearing, and it's hard to, you know, figure out what the real facts are. So that might be useful.
Thanks.
And so while we're rushing you out on your testimony, we will take your testimony very seriously and continue to discuss it.
Thank you, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Thank you.
We'll now move to the next part of the agenda. And Greg, we don't have any. I believe Ms. Kirsten is going to come forward while Senator Olson comes back to the table. So, Ms. Kirsten, introduce yourself for the record and give us a little overview why you're here today. Thanks.
I am Catherine Kirsten. I am a senior fellow at Center for the American Experiment. And I want to thank Madam Chair and members of the committee for having me here today to testify about a report the Center is releasing this afternoon, Our Immense Achievement Gap, Embracing Proven Remedies While Avoiding a Race-Based Recipe for Disaster. I think everyone here knows the statistics on the racial learning gap in Minnesota. We know that in fourth grade reading, our state's black and Hispanic children on average lag 3 years behind their white peers. We know that our gap in this respect in recent years has been the worst of any state in the nation, barring only the District of Columbia. And at higher grades, well, the story's even worse. On recent state assessments, 55% of white 11th graders tested proficient in math, nothing to be proud of, but only 16% of black students and only 22% of Hispanic students tested as proficient. Now, as Minnesotans, we need to understand and confront the toll that this kind of educational failure imposes. 43% of Americans with the lowest literacy skills live in poverty. 70% of our prison inmates struggle with reading. And this is not just a problem for North Minneapolis. Today, there's a demographic sea change going on in Minnesota, which is transforming this tragic learning gap into a full-blown educational crisis that affects all of us. To give you a bit of a sense for what's happening, in 1995, Twin Cities suburban enrollment was 8% minority. Today, inner ring suburbs, it's 37%, 22% in outer ring suburbs, and 26% across the state. Since 1998, Bloomington schools have gone from 7% minority to 39% minority, Richfield from 14% to 68% minority, Roseville from 9.6 to 40% minority. In 1996, Shakopee schools had only 11 Hispanic students. In 2009, the district had 700 Hispanic students, ranking third in the nation in terms of Hispanic growth. In the 20 years, nearly half of Hennepin County and Ramsey County residents are expected to be members of minority groups. So it's clear that in the future, our state's democratic vitality and its economic prosperity depends in a major way on finding ways to successfully address this learning gap. Now, it's important as we look at the gap to try to understand accurately its sources in order to devise the right solution. And social science evidence is very clear that the gap is caused primarily by socioeconomic or family risk factors that often leave children lacking in the basic skills and general knowledge that they need for academic success. And these factors include family structure, one or two parents, low parental educational attainments and income, poor parental nurturance behavior. I think we get a sense for one of the major sources of the gap by looking at the out-of-wedlock birth rate in Hennepin County. Among U.S.-born black citizens of Hennepin County, the out-of-wedlock birth rate is 84.3%. For Hispanics in Hennepin County, it's 61.5%, and it's 18% for whites. Now, children who start life wrestling with disadvantages of this kind need classroom-based reforms that work, and these include intense focus on fundamentals of reading and math, and targeted and data-driven assessment and intervention, and a school climate that emphasizes order and high expectations and accountability. And here in our own backyard, we have a number of examples of shining success in this regard. Beat the odds schools like Harvest Prep, like Concordia Creative Learning Academy. Sometimes these schools have actually excelled affluent suburban districts in terms of the reading and math scores of their 3 through 8 students. Nationally, I believe that we've all heard about the kinds of strides that the state of Florida has made in increasing minority academic achievement. But today, as my report demonstrates, the Minnesota Department of Education and 3 influential additional state education institutions are generally taking a very different course, a very different approach to the learning gap, which I'm afraid is doomed to fail. And this approach is to make racial balance in schools, mislabeled integration, the touchstone of improved minority academic achievement. The problem is that these plans put forward by these 4 institutions view children and education reform through the lens of race. And in the report, which, by the way, is available for everybody here after the hearing, I examined 4 learning gap-related plans from Minnesota education institutions. The first is the Minnesota Department of Education, and it's a May 2011 plan called Funding Education for the Future. This is a blueprint for future education funding, which urges the Minnesota legislature to declare integration, that is, racially balanced schools, as a compelling interest of the state and a key to closing the racial learning gap. Now, this report includes very few details and does not define integration. For the details, it's helpful to look to an organization that Commissioner Caselius has publicly partnered with to create in the future integration benchmarks and metrics and timetables and standards. And this is an organization called the Educational Equity Organizing Collaborative, or EEOC, which is a nonprofit community organizing group. And it has a learning gap-related plan called 16 Solutions That Deliver Equity and Excellence in Education. And there are 2 central facts there I'd like to point to. First is that this plan would make racial balance in the schools absolutely regards it as essential to addressing the learning gap effectively. And second is that this plan states that educational equity should be viewed going forward as requiring schools to close the racial and ethnic gap on four measures, not just test scores, but graduation rates, suspension and expulsion rates, and rates of participation in remedial and college prep classes. Going forward, I think, given the public partnership between MDE and the EEOC, we can expect benchmarks and metrics that focus on integration to make these kinds of requirements a centerpiece in Minnesota rule and law. The third organization with a learning gap-related plan is the Minnesota School Integration Council. And this is a council, an organization, whose members are largely districts that receive integration revenue. Now, this organization has a 17-page plan called Every Child, Every Day, Educational Equity Through Integration. And I'll focus on just two aspects of that plan. First of all, the council proposes redefining educational equity in ways that would shift the focus of educational fairness in Minnesota from equal opportunity to equal academic results by all racial and ethnic groups. Sadly, this is an outcome that has not been achieved anywhere to date. And to achieve this goal of closing the gap, the council proposes that every district in Minnesota should be required to submit a multifaceted integration plan to MDE. It calls for intra and inter-district busing, race-based changes in school assignment, and it also would create a sprawling new bureaucracy that would award power over Minnesota public schools to a mind-numbing array of special interest groups. The final organization with a plan of this kind is the Institute on Race and Poverty at the U of M Law School, and its plan is called A Comprehensive Strategy to Integrate Schools and Neighborhoods. And this plan calls for a 7-county metro-wide integration district, or several super districts, that would stretch from Forest Lake to Stillwater to Orono to Farmington, the entire metro area. And under this plan, all metro school districts would be required to participate. There would be a racial ceiling and floor for every district, and almost inevitably, if this plan were adopted, mandatory race-based school assignments would occur in the future. Now, we know that race-based plans to raise minority achievement simply don't work. This is a theory that's been tested across America in a massive and hugely expensive social science experiment between 1970 and 1995. And today, there's a mountain of data after 40 years that shows that these kinds of efforts, moving kids around on the basis of race to improve their math and reading scores and skills, have failed overwhelmingly. And I'll just give you one example. That's the Kansas City, which in the early 1990s had what was at that point the most expensive plan of this kind in the nation. It cost $2 billion. And to fund it, a federal judge ordered, over the objections of the local city council, a doubling of property taxes. Today, 20 years later, the Kansas City students are performing so poorly that the district has lost its academic accreditation from the state of Missouri, and its fate is uncertain. This is not an unusual story when we look at efforts to help kids by moving them around on the basis of race. And there's a similar story here in Minnesota. Our students in Minneapolis and St. Paul were bused for over 20 years on the basis of race, and all we have to show for it is our yawning racial achievement gap today. Last year, the St. Paul schools finally rejected school assignments that looked at race after a year-long study documented that minority kids in St. Paul did as well or better in their neighborhood schools. And I'm a great proponent of school choice, but the outcome of The Choice Is Yours, which is a voluntary city-suburb busing program for low-income kids, has been very disappointing. The same goes for the efforts of our three Twin Cities integration districts. They have been so disappointing in performance that the District of Minneapolis has announced its attempt or its intention to pull out of WEMAP, and some suburban districts have withdrawn from another local integration district, EMID. Now, the four learning gap-related plans that I've just described would have another truly dire consequence, and that is that under the radar, they will place the state of Minnesota in grave legal peril. All of these plans are structured in a way that would set up the state of Minnesota for massive legal liabilities in an education adequacy lawsuit of the kind that has brought financial disaster to many other states. And it's likely that an education adequacy suit will be filed. Here it looms, I suspect, just around the corner. Two prominent attorneys have already raised the prospect of or directly threatened such a suit. And an education adequacy suit would be brought by school districts, parents, activists, education groups. These plaintiffs will claim that the state of Minnesota is not offering its children a constitutionally mandated adequate education. And they will blame the learning gap not on family risk factors, which is what social science documents is the primary cause of the gap, but they will blame it instead on underfunding of K-12 education by the legislature and or on the lack of racial balance in Minnesota schools. And these plaintiffs will claim that the measures that I've just mentioned, that is, a great increase in school funding or a metro-wide race-based busing plan, is constitutionally mandated to address the gap. Now, these adequacy suits can entangle courts and schools for decades. They've been brought in dozens of states. But the tragedy is that they have failed everywhere to improve the academic achievements of poor and minority children. And here's what we can expect in Minnesota. Looking at what happened in Colorado just 2 months ago, plaintiffs won a case like this in Colorado. They are demanding an annual increase in state K-12 funding of up to $4 billion. They are demanding up to $17 billion in new school construction funds. The state's Democratic governor has warned that this could bankrupt the state, could lead to a 50% increase in taxes in the state of Colorado, could lead to serious cuts in funding for other priorities like Medicaid, like public safety, higher education. Another example is New Jersey, where this kind of litigation has been underway for 40 years and has brought gigantic tax hikes, major state borrowing, and it's led to a near revolt over property taxes. And unbelievably, the state of New Jersey now spends in low-income districts up to $30,000 a year per pupil on education. Sadly, we haven't seen the racial learning gap improve as a result. In Hartford, Connecticut, in 1996, the state Supreme Court ordered a metro-wide busing scheme very much like the one that plaintiffs are likely to seek here. The monumental cost of this plan has pushed state and local education budgets to the brink. But sadly, we still see a yawning racial achievement gap in Hartford. Now, the learning gap plans of these four organizations taken together include provisions that would pave the way for this kind of victory in the state of Minnesota. And I'll be brief here. There are three ways in which they do this primarily. First of all, in its plan, the Minnesota Department of Education and others urge the legislature to define integration as a compelling state interest. The MDE doesn't explain why, but it's important to understand that the fact that compelling interest is a profoundly significant legal buzzword, because under the U.S. Constitution, racial classification is constitutional only if a court decides that it advances a compelling state interest. And if this kind of language is incorporated in Minnesota, plaintiffs will argue that it creates or confirms a constitutional duty to balance Minnesota schools by race or income and to greatly increase K-12 funding. The second way that the plans would increase chances of a plaintiff victory in this kind of suit are that they would create a new framework, for measuring whether Minnesota students are receiving an adequate or equitable education. And in particular, the Minnesota School Integration Council plan does this by redefining equal educational opportunity in a way that would make closing the racial gap the central measure of whether students are receiving an adequate education here. And if this language is adopted, we can expect a court to order in response massive new funding of our schools that is very unlikely to lead to the objective that all of us seek. The third and final way that these plans would create a risk of plaintiff victory in an education adequacy suit is they would require the state of Minnesota to, quote, ensure that low-income students achieve the same academic outcomes as higher-income students. And the problem with this language is that if it were adopted, it would foreclose the state of Minnesota from using one of the most potent defenses that education adequacy defendants have available. And this is the argument that the state can't be held responsible for the racial and ethnic achievement gap because that gap arises from family risk factors that are sadly largely beyond the schools and the state's control. Now, collaboration between plaintiffs and state defendants is common in education adequacy suits. The problem is that state education officials, although they are nominally defendants in these suits, often share the plaintiff's goal of greatly increased K-12 funding in the state. And collaboration can seriously compromise a state's ability to defend itself in this kind of suit. And if you look at the MDE's plan, Funding Education for the Future, you see that the very first priority listed is to improve the adequacy, equity, and stability of pre-K 12 education funding, all buzzwords that have serious legal implications. And then, of course, the compelling interest language I mentioned before. And I think Minnesota legislatures and citizens need to know that if these plans are adopted, they will lay the legal groundwork for a plaintiff victory in this kind of suit, which is very likely to confront us soon. One final point. I've talked about the fact that strong evidence shows that the primary cause of the achievement gap is family risk factors, and that to help kids effectively, we need serious classroom-based reform that will help them learn to read and do math effectively. The state-level educational groups I've talked about have chosen to take a different route, but we see a similar mistake being made at the district level as well. More and more, we're finding emphasis on so-called cultural competency training, which maintains that it is teachers who are responsible for the racial gap, the teachers who are causing and perpetuating it through their own white racist behavior, conscious or unconscious. And an organization that is very influential in promoting this view, especially in the Twin Cities metro area, is called the Pacific Educational Group, or PEG. PEG is one of the most important providers of cultural competency training, and those who have checked this estimate that districts here have spent as much as $2 million together on PEG services. Now, PEG, ironically, promotes racial stereotypes that it's to be hoped that mainstream America abandoned decades ago. It teaches Minnesota educators and students, for example, and I'm quoting here, that white individualism fosters individual achievement, that white people are intellectual, they're capable of quantitative thinking, but black and brown people, quote, have a very different culture. That's a culture that promotes collectivism. Black and brown people are emotional. They are interested in feelings. They communicate through, quote, body motions, like rolling of the eyes and sighs and other nonverbal expressions. My report contains many examples of how this perverse ideology is playing out in Minnesota and how it harms the very students that we need most to help. Now, a prominent Minnesota education official has called the racial gap a freight train coming at this state, and he is right. We have failed our poor and minority students for too long because we have viewed them through the lens of race. And today, we have a moral obligation to adopt classroom and school-based reforms with a track record of success and to avoid race-based solutions that have failed in the past and are certain to fail again in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've packed a lot into a short amount of time.
Not bad. Yeah, it's 125 pages. So.
Thank you very much for providing that, because we will be having discussions, I know, on this subject going forward. So thank you very much for sharing and
thank you, Madam Chair and members of
the committee. Releasing that for our use. And I believe the meeting is adjourned. It says we are called back to session, and we will be meeting again on Monday.
regular time. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.